Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly program about health, fitness, nutrition, and all things lifestyle. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Good morning, Lynn. I'm Graham Anthony. Today on The Mountain Life, we begin with dyslexia, as October is Dyslexia Awareness Month. One in five children has dyslexia. Really staggering numbers. How do you help your child detect it, deal with it, and have reading and academic success despite it? We speak with Barbara Wierowski-Morelli, founder of the Joseph James Morelli Scholarship Fund, and Donald Pons, a dyslexia consultant and screener at the University of Utah, about dyslexia awareness.
Yes, interesting conversation coming up. And before I continue, I happen to know it's your birthday, Graham. Happy birthday.
Is this a trick question? Thank you very much. It is indeed my birthday.
Good. Glad I could call it out on air.
Seems like it's just a year ago.
And then our second guest is about cancer, and it's a book written by cancer survivor Laura Holmes Hadid. It's called This Is Cancer, Everything You Need to Know from the Waiting Room to the Bedroom. Not the book that any of us want to have occasion to purchase, but it is the book that brings to light the practical things you need to think about and do.
And finally, Marlene Judd from Park City Hospital joins to talk about the new breast imaging technology at the hospital.
This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters.
Hi, I'm Whitney Wall from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including Snowfest, the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all the events happening at Park City Mountain this winter can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Valley Behavioral Health is a local nonprofit and proud supporter of KPCW. We are your community behavioral health center and provide a broad range of services, including individual, family, couples, and group therapy for mental health and substance abuse. We serve all ages in all of Summit County. Please check out our website at valleycares.com or 649-8347 for more information.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host, Graham Anthony. Well, there are staggering statistics out there about lack of reading success, about dyslexia, and what happens when kids don't get help experiencing success in reading. We know that one in five students has dyslexia, 10 million American students struggle to read, but only 2.3 million students are identified as having dyslexia, and then get to receive special help. We're joined by two people fighting the good fight to bring awareness to dyslexia and to provide support to dyslexic kids. Barbara Wierowski-Morelli is the founder of the Joseph James Morelli Scholarship Fund, and Donnell Pons is a dyslexia consultant and screener at the University of Utah. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Lynn and Graham and Donnell. Thank you for having us here.
So, Donnell, maybe you could start with talking about some of these statistics that are hard to believe. And, let's just start with that because you work with them every day at the University of Utah.
Yeah, so I have a job there in the evenings as a tutor at the University of Utah Reading Clinic. But also, I think I came to my biggest awareness of this issue of reading as an educator in the classroom. And I had one of my first teaching jobs after graduating, and I was so bright-eyed and idealistic. I had 225 students as a seventh-grade English teacher here in Salt Lake City. And of those students, I probably had one class that was on grade level with reading, and that's seventh grade we're talking about. And then all the rest of the students were anywhere from a couple of grade levels below to even down to first grade, and they're in seventh grade and unidentified. And this is something we readily accept in the United States, that some students are just going to take to reading and some are not, and there's nothing we can do about it when there's plenty we can do about it.
So as we were talking about before, it's up until about third grade that you're learning how to read, and after that you're reading to learn, as they say. So is it true then that at third grade we sort of stop helping these still emerging readers, because any third grader, even if they're a great reader, you know, hasn't achieved true, you know, their potential with reading. And so the kids that are left behind, I mean, wow, they're really left behind.
Yeah, so there are a couple of contributing factors. Yes, in the United States, that is pretty widely accepted that K through 3, we're teaching kids how to read. And then beyond that, now we're teaching kids to read to access information. But we do know that by the end of third grade, we have a great number of students who have not received the literacy help that they need or the skills that they need. Roughly two-thirds of the population is going to take to reading regardless. They're wired for it. They're going to take to it. But we know that reading is not a natural thing. Speaking is natural, but the reading the code, this man-made code, is not natural, and that more kids are going to need help with it to access it. But we don't give it its due. We're not training our teachers like they need to be trained in order to be really reading experts, because that's really what it takes in order to help those students.
And Donnell just mentioned something that I think is really interesting. It's the brain's wiring. You know, in ophthalmology, we recognize the fact that if you do not diagnose or pick up a lazy eye before roughly age 8 to 10, which is around 3rd to 4th grade, you lose the opportunity to actually improve the vision. And it has to do with the brain's wiring. It's when the child is younger that the brain is so plastic and can actually be rewired, and you can learn these skills, whether it's visual or reading and language. But that's the early age that these children really need to have the intervention.
And what are the core principles for doing that rewiring?
So any good reading program, what we're looking at is phonemic awareness, and that is being able to map the sounds to the letters. And that is key and critical. And in fact, we can know if a student is going to take to reading just by testing their phonemic awareness, and that can be done as young as 3 years old.
So so the phonics programs are really useful for that?
Yeah, and an understanding, too, of phonics and phonemic awareness, those are two different things. Phonics is when I introduce a letter, so it's probably easier to think of it. Phonemic awareness is if you're in the dark and I just quiz you on sounds. I have you take sounds apart, I have you drop sounds and delete them, and you're doing that without seeing letters. Now when I introduce letters, that's phonics, and those are two different things. And even that right there is a critical point for teachers to know.
Hmm. Want to ask you, Barbara, about your son, Joseph, who very sadly is no longer with us. But this is why you kicked off this foundation upon his death, because you went through this with him. And I want to ask you about this because you and your husband are both doctors. You both are very well educated. You are very in tune to all of your children. And yet it wasn't until Joseph was, I think, in high school, it was early high school, that he was identified as being dyslexic. You always knew he was smart, but did you think either he was just sort of lazy or he didn't like school? Or, I mean, how did he not get identified with actively involved parents being in the park? Was he in the Park City? He wasn't in the Park
New
City
York,
School District.
New York, until.
New York, but no doubt a great school district as well.
Yeah. And I think you hit the nail on the head. He was our first child. We were always told that he was very smart, but he was a slow reader. This was average for boys. Boys some take longer than girls. He was also slow with speech, so we had him in speech when he was very little. And we did for a long time. We felt like we failed him as a parent because we couldn't understand. The teachers would always tell us, he's not trying hard enough. He's not trying hard enough. He has so much more potential. So we would say to him, Joseph, you're not trying hard enough. And it wasn't until the kid was really at the depths of failing everything that we said something is not right. And even then, the school district, which was actually one of the best in the nation, the guidance counselor told us, well, maybe he's not high school material. Maybe he should be pulled out and put into vocational school.
Wow.
And went on to tell us that, you know, we would have picked it up. Our school system is so good that we would have picked it up. And, you know, to Donnell's point, when he graduated high school here in Park City, which just did amazingly well for him and right by him, he was off the charts in math and science, but still at a sixth grade reading level because we didn't do the Wilson and the Orton-Gillingham until ninth grade, which was, his brain wasn't plastic enough anymore. It was much more of a struggle for him to learn to read. And he used to joke all the time, Mom, I can't read. You know I can't read. You know, I'd give him something to read. I'd say, oh, read this. And I'd turn the page. He's like, wait a minute. I didn't finish it yet. You know I can't read. Mm. And he learned his strengths and weaknesses and how to adjust to them.
Right.
And, you know, Barbara makes a really good point. People often think dyslexics can't read. They can read. They just can't do it very well. Mm-hmm. And they're struggling far harder than they should with it. So that's another fallacy, too.
Right, right. So we were talking off air before we began the show about all these people we know who are very successful and dyslexic, and we were amazed to to recount these stories of how hard they must have had to work being dyslexic. And Joseph was the same, but he was experiencing huge success at the university level in Bozeman.
Yes. So as I'm learning now, and this is really how Donnell and I met, and the reason why, again, thank you for having us here to talk about it, is we think we diagnose them. We think we give them accommodations. They go on to college, and everything's laid out for them. And for Joseph, Montana State really was. They've got a great disability department. They really went above and beyond to provide him with what he needed. And now as I see these children that we funded, so in the last 3 years, we've got 31 kids over 13 states that we've awarded the scholarship to. And in keeping in touch with them, I'm seeing that there's a huge disparity in secondary learning, in these higher, education situations, and the children are not getting what they need. And they're really set up for failure once again. And I'm trying to wrap my hands around this. It just doesn't seem fair.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Joseph James Morelli Scholarship Fund, how students are identified and how they are treated once they're in the program?
Yes. So the application opens up the end of December, early January, and it's a grant anywhere from, anywhere up to $2,500 or $3,000. And actually this year we're going to even shoot for higher funding. It's a one-year scholarship. They can use it towards testing, tutoring, resources, computer, anything, tuition, anything that helps them achieve. They have to be either high school or college, and they need to be going into a STEM, so science, technology, engineering, or math field, because Joseph was an engineer at MSU. So we made that one of the criteria.
And how are they learning about the opportunities to apply for this?
So this is actually really amazing, and I'm blown away by this, but we actually have been picked up all over the nation. So our true heart here is in Utah, in particular Park City. We always want to award the Park City students, so we work really closely with the school district and the high school. But we are picked up nationally by Dyslexia Initiatives, the Association for Dyslexia, and we also are partnering with the National Center for Learning Disabilities, which is based in New York.
So during their primary education and secondary, they're getting an individual, if they're identified, that is, if they don't fall through the cracks, they'll get an IEP, an individualized education plan. That allows them things like extra time on tests and some extra reading help. Is that how it goes?
So, you've brought up a really interesting point. Typically, our kids with dyslexia, and Joseph was one of those who's so bright that they may or may not get picked up. And the criteria to receive an IEP, oftentimes our kids with dyslexia aren't going to get picked up. So they might end up with a 504, and that is different from an IEP. Now, on the IEP, you should get specialized programming that's supposed to help that student be able to acquire the skills, be able to meet their peers, right? But the 504 won't do that. What it does is the accommodations piece. So it will give you the extended time. It will give you, maybe options for writing assignments, that sort of a thing. That's the 504. But what's critical for these kids with dyslexia that we want people to understand is that it is never too late to intervene and help students learn to read. We have programs available today within the United States. Barbara mentioned one with the Wilson Reading Program. That is one that's Orton-Gillingham based. And Orton-Gillingham means that it's based on a method of bringing the reading down to the smallest phonemes to be able to help students acquire the reading skills that they need. So we know how to help our students with reading. We have great, solid programs. We just need to get it in the hands of our educators so that they can offer it to their students. And also so they can have the skills to be able to identify kids who need this type of help with their reading.
So are there any national programs that are supporting kids who are going from high school, they've gotten help in high school, and they've made it to college, which really, what a great success story. Uh-huh. They get into college, and then they're just a number.
Yep.
I mean, it sounds like in Bozeman, that wasn't the case.
But it's state by state, and that's what the National Center for Learning Disabilities has recognized, is they call it the young adults. And that's where, because our scholarship is geared towards young adults, that's one of the things that we're going to talk about partnering with them on, is how do we make it national. Right now it's state by state. university by university, school by school. There's no consistency.
Yeah.
Wow.
And Barbara, I think your story, not only is the scholarship beautiful that students have an opportunity to receive funding, but it also sheds a light on something we haven't had a lot of attention put towards, and that is our kids in college. Mm-hmm. And what are we doing to help support them be successful there?
Mm-hmm. I think what really just highlighted this to me was two of the students. One of them's a Park City student that graduated. His mom is very involved with his education. And, you know, these kids are put into the University of Utah, was the specific place. Two of our students are there now in engineering. They both received the scholarship, and they are both struggling and actually failed their midterm because although they were supposed to get the allotted time, the professor said, oh, sorry, you didn't let me know enough time ahead to actually allow you to have that extra time on that chemistry midterm. And they proceeded to fail because they didn't have the time. And yet these kids know the subject.
Yeah, that's the heartbreaking part. And so we've talked about the IEP and the 504. Kids will exit that high school system. Maybe they had one or both of these protecting them. But then when they get to college, you no longer have your IEP, your individualized education plan.
They just don't do that.
No, they don't. And so now you come underneath the auspices of ADA. So it's Americans with Disabilities Act. Or if you have a 504, it's a civil liberties thing, a civil rights thing, to be able to have accommodations. Right. And then you also have to go through now their Office of Accommodations at the university. So you go through yet another office. Even if you have all the testing done, you'll go through their own Office of Accommodation. They'll do their own testing to decide what sort of level of support they're willing to provide for you. So it's a whole other system that these students who've already gone through so much to get through high school now have to go through yet another system to be able to navigate college. And so we're asking a lot of these students. Yeah. You think about when you started college and all the things you were trying to figure out as a new college student, you had this extra piece of how do I get my accommodations? Mm-hmm. And then it's all on the student to go and negotiate with professors and to talk to professors. And if you have some that are open to it and have been made aware and they're willing to help, that's terrific. If you don't, that's a whole other struggle for students. So you think about the bar that we've just set for these kids to be able to do college. It is remarkable that they do so well. Yeah.
Wow. Thinking of a great friend of mine, one of the smartest people I know, got to college, knew that he was dyslexic, but, you know, it just didn't work. So he drops out of college. Luckily, he makes his way through the world and very successful. Now his son is having some difficulty with reading. And I know that I didn't know this until this month during Dyslexia Awareness Month. It's genetic.
Yes. Yeah.
So for those parents out there who are thinking, gosh, my second grader, is in the bottom reading group or whatever. What are some of the things that you should know, just little things, you know, so that we're not all dismissing it by saying, oh, he's just a little lazy or he's distracted or she is, interested in other things more than school? What do we look for?
There's a lot of things we can do, thank heavens. So one of the things I would do immediately is to have the parent aware that do not sit back and say, they will grow out of it, or let's wait and see. That we no longer do. We don't wait and see. So if that's been said to them, they need to go back and say, we're not going to wait and see. The other piece is get a hold of any data that you can on where your student stands with reading. So in the state of Utah, we all do DIBELS testing in this state. So every student gets DIBELS tested K-3 at the beginning, middle, and end of the year. You have that data. Now, in that data, it will tell how well your student is doing with those parts and components of reading that they should be getting at different stages. And then you want to sit on that information and make sure your student is not in, they color code it. Red is not okay. Yellow is not okay. Your student needs to be green. And so if your student isn't making it to green, then we need to talk about that. The other thing is don't wait till the end of the year. If you've talked about it at the first of the year, you need to be able to see progress monitoring to make sure they are getting what they need. And again, you want to be able to talk to somebody at the school and find out if somebody has been trained in reading and reading intervention and have a conversation. Are they saying the right things? Do they know about phonemic awareness? Do they know about phonics? Do they know about syllable types and helping your student understand the basics of reading? You want to be able to hear this language and information. There are great programs, and Park City District is one of those that's implementing Wilson Reading, which is Orton Gillingham based. And Dr. Barbara Wilson's going to be here tonight in Park City, so I applaud you guys for doing that. And she has a terrifically successful program. That right there is a great option for school.
Right.
Yes. And we actually have the Park City. So we have PC Reads here, too. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously that we all know about. That was started by Alyssa Atten and Jackie Blake because of the need. And then the Hall Fund, the Hall Family Fund, Joseph and Alex were best of friends in high school, and they were both dyslexic. And then when Joseph passed away and in talking with the Halls, they really wanted to do something to make a difference. And they actually are the ones funding the Wilson program in the school system, which is amazing. But yeah. I think one thing, you go from being, don't, you know, what I would say to parents is don't worry about going from the parent that no one knows to the parent that everyone knows, mm-hmm. because you have to advocate for your child.
Yeah, absolutely. Give us the details on tonight's talk. We're out of time, unfortunately.
But. So it's, as Donnell mentioned, Barbara Wilson's going to be here with her husband, yeah. Ed, and the Doctors Wilson will be at the high school starting at 6 to 7:30. And again, that's brought here by PC Reads and the Hall Family Fund.
And this is for families with children of any age.
Any age. Anyone who wants to know about or learn about the Wilson-based method, the Wilson Foundations. And Wyoming actually has always had Wilson Foundations as their reading program, and now it's being introduced to the Park City District.
Excellent. Donnell Pons is a dyslexia consultant and screener at the University of Utah. Barbara Warusko Morelli is the founder of the Joseph James Morelli Scholarship Fund and a regular here on our shows on KPCW. And thank you to both of you. Great information and congratulations on the great work that you do.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thank you both.
And we'll be back after these words when we return.
Matt here from San Francisco Design. Since the start of our business in 1990, we have been supporting KPCW. We offer home decor for Park City and Salt Lake and feature modern furnishings from around the world. Whether you're looking to furnish an entire home or just redecorating a single room, we can help with our in-house design team. Located on Bonanza Drive and on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak, here with Graham Anthony. Well, none of us wants to be the one who hears these words, you have cancer. But the solemn fact is that many of us will hear this. In fact, about 35% or more of us. Our next guest is a cancer survivor of stage 4 inflammatory breast cancer. Laura Holmes Haddad said she went from feeling great, lots of yoga and broccoli, as she says, to not feeling great and having doctors tell her that she had a tumor and she would have 3 to 5 years to live. Well, she's still here and she found it crucial to share some of the cancer basics, these practical details that you'll have to deal with if you one day hear the same diagnosis that she did. Laura, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Well, thank you for having me.
Really nice to have you. I mean, this book is amazing. It really is the book of basics, these practical tips. We think so much about, you know, the emotional component and I just love what you've done here. Was there no other book like it when you were diagnosed?
Well, I appreciate your reaction to it. There was nothing out there. I really wrote the book that I wanted to read but couldn't find. And as you mentioned, it's all those little details that make a big impact on a patient's quality of life.
Right. So can you take us through your diagnosis? I mean, stage 4 inflammatory breast cancer. How long ago were you diagnosed?
So I received my diagnosis the day after Thanksgiving in 2012. I had turned 37 that summer. I had finished nursing our then around 12-month-old son. We had a 4-year-old daughter, and I didn't feel great, you know, but as a tired, busy mom, and I think women in general, we kind of just tend to, you know, put our heads down and keep going. But by November, I felt so poorly that I went to see my GP, and she first told me I had mastitis, a breast infection,
right.
But told me to see a breast surgeon just to be sure. And the next week, I saw the breast surgeon who did a biopsy, ultrasound, and mammogram, and 4 days later was told that I had inflammatory breast cancer, which is a rare, aggressive form of breast cancer. I had an 11-centimeter tumor, and it had spread to 20 lymph nodes as well as a rib. And my treatment, I started chemo protocol of 3 rounds of chemo, about to start the third round. I was told it wasn't working. and my only hope at that point was a clinical drug trial.
Your adventure through this, what you call the road trip, Laura, is fascinating and almost classic in what you just described, that an initial consultation is a complete misdirect. And fortunately, you found a correction to that. Did you enter it with open eyes and any experience with this within your family, with friends?
Nothing. No, I was blissfully unaware, as I say. My aunt had been diagnosed with breast cancer 5 years before, but it was stage two, nothing too worrisome in that sense. But no, everything that I knew about cancer was from TV and movies, and I thought it was, chemo and scarves and you get on with your life, and obviously it's about a billion different things from that.
Well, you delineate an extraordinary story for yourself that is, again, it is the common thread for cancer survivors, and I guess why you are a big supporter of support groups in the end, because being able to share your stories is so helpful.
It's so important to find people that you can talk to who you feel understand you. It's the most isolating experience, and that's something that completely surprised me. I say you're surrounded by people, but you often feel alone. Everyone wishes you well and means so well, but no one really gets you like someone who's been through it.
That's right. And so, this is the thing. I found myself drawn to the chapters or the excerpts in your book that talked about the rest of us out there. It talked about who not to share with and what not to say, the things that you don't want to hear. So could you just run through some of those things?
Yes. That was the things that people say, mostly obviously well-meaning, but they can come off in a different way. Things like, how are you, said with very wide eyes and sad eyes, and things like, in terms of breast cancer, well, at least you get a new pair of boobs at the end of it.
That's
someone
bad.
Said that because I was getting so much food dropped off by an amazing community, someone said, well, think about how much money you're saving in groceries. So... you just have to grin and bear it. But I just think it's helpful to kind of lay those things out there. And I should also say, I put in things of what patients, how we should talk to our caregivers, because they're on this road trip with us, and no one really knows what to say, right? So if you have just a few helpful phrases or guiding words, I think it can ease the emotional side of it just a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, we all mean well, and we just don't know what to say. And sometimes we think if we just say something, it's going to be better than saying nothing. My son went through Hodgkin's lymphoma when he was 7, and I remember the people that would say to me, "How did he get cancer?" And I wanted to punch them, that one was a particularly difficult one. But I knew that you have to surmount that emotionally, because they are just reaching out and they don't know what to say. No one knows what to say. But that's why this little book, especially if you're close to someone who's just been diagnosed, or a caregiver, a friend, a relative, to read your book, This Is Cancer, and garner some information. So I love that.
On that point, it truly is a book for everyone. This is not for the individual with cancer or their family. This is for people who are going to encounter friends and family, colleagues with cancer, and it's extremely helpful. I have to say, you've taken a very practical, very personal and very thoughtful, analytical approach to this. And you've also done a brilliant thing. I don't know whose idea it was, but it's a compact size that can be slipped into a bag easily and taken and pulled out in a waiting room having chemo. And I know there's nothing else to do while getting chemo. a quick question for you, Laura. In the as you go through the stages of realizing your life is changing, and it is it will change forever, your first contact with the other side of this in the medical community, healthcare community, in reality is going to be that oncologist. And can you describe what you went through in finding the right person for you, the right doctor for you, and how others can make that decision themselves?
Yes, this is an important point. I had always been someone who went to the doctor, you know, said, yes, okay, let's get started, not realizing that I, as a patient, had a say, could exercise my voice, and not only could participate, you must participate, you know, in these conversations. This is your body. You have a right to say what is happening. And I didn't know that I wasn't allowed to not like my doctors. You know, I went through one or two oncologists in the beginning, and it just was not the right fit. And then I ended up at UCSF and found someone who is just remarkable. And, you know, he doesn't necessarily ask about my kids. He doesn't know my favorite color, you know, but he saved my life. And he is empathetic, and he is there for me, and he knows what he is doing, and that's what you need. And to just feel comfortable saying, you know, I'm the patient, and I want to feel comfortable in all aspects of my care, it's an important lesson to learn. It took me many months to learn that.
Yes, and can you talk then about that first opinion and about the second opinion? Should we always get a second opinion?
Yes, I feel very strongly about this. I think no matter what your diagnosis is, I mean, obviously I had a more rare form of cancer, so my family was, you know, very much pushing for a second and even a third opinion. But I think it's so important to get the second opinion, even if it's the same, just to confirm the diagnosis. And if it's finances that are stopping you or preventing you from seeking the second opinion, you just need to realize there are a lot of resources out there that can help you pay for that if needed. Some health insurance companies will cover the second opinion, and some do not. But that shouldn't stop you, you know, if you're, especially if you're facing a more rare or you know, poor prognosis.
How did you come to the decision to undergo a trial? You call it the little green, what do you call it? The green chemo?
The little green chemotherapy trial drug. Oh, my savior. When I found out that I had, you know, stage four, and they said, okay, chemotherapy. And then when I found out it was failing, and I moved over to UCSF, and my doctor, my oncologist said, their only hope at this point is a trial. And before that, if you had asked me if I would go on a trial, I would have said, absolutely not. I don't want to be a guinea pig. But I didn't know. I didn't know the reality of trials. I didn't know really anything about them. And then to have to fight to get into one, when I finally got on the trial on a compassionate use waiver, and I had to travel to the trial at City of Hope in Los Angeles, and then it worked. In 6 months, this particular trial drug shrunk my tumor and made me eligible for surgery, and that's what saved my life. So I cannot say enough about medical research and the importance of clinical drug trials and educating yourself about trials. Don't be misled by, you know, myths or what people might tell you. You know, do the research. They're so important, especially now, with so much happening in the cancer world in terms of research.
I think this week we've heard some extraordinary stories. I don't know if this relates to the treatment that you had regarding precision targeting of cancers, but we are on the cusp of really making some big changes in how cancer affects all of our lives.
And that's exactly why I'm alive today, is precision medicine, that my oncologist worked with a molecular biologist and looked at my genetic profile. I'm a BRCA2 carrier, and based on that information, they were able to identify a trial that they thought would work, and it worked. So, you know, this is not voodoo. This is happening now. And my oncologist said in 2012, if you had come in 5 years before, I would have had nothing for you. But he had something then. And I really think that shows you how quickly the science is moving and opening up treatment options for patients.
It is. And I appreciate that you have taken the time in the wake of this experience to write the, again, it's an extraordinary book. And I wanted to talk about not just the cancer and the science of it, but you have a section on your highs and lows that I thought were very touching and compelling. Can you go through a bit of that?
Yes. I think there's nothing like facing your own mortality to really have you, you know, see the highest and the lowest points of your road trip, as I call it. And I felt like sharing those would really show people, you know, the personal side. For example, a couple of highs were my daughter saying, "You are a one and only." Another high was when a gas station cashier in Los Angeles, I stopped to get a ginger ale after chemo, and she looked at me and she bought me a lottery ticket and said, "You look like you could use it." Another high was just being able to honor my oncologist. I got to present him with a hospital award, and I got to thank him and acknowledge him in front of his colleagues, which was a huge honor for me. A few of the lows were thinking about someone other than me being called mommy. Another one was kissing my kids goodnight on the nights before my surgeries. And another one was having our house robbed and my husband's family heirloom stolen while I was away getting chemotherapy.
Yeah, remarkable moments to ponder. And you are very gracious regarding the support that you got across the healthcare community, particularly to the innumerable nurses you credit with being there for you, and the one or two who were less than helpful. But it's a sweet story woven through a practical guide for anyone who is touched by cancer. And the fact is, we are all touched by cancer.
It is everywhere. And my intention is to make it just a little bit easier for patients, caregivers, you know, the medical community, and everyone around who wants so much to help. And I just wanted to share the things that I didn't know, you know, thinking I couldn't possibly be the only person who didn't know these things. So I'm very appreciative that I'm still here and that I got to pay it forward.
Absolutely. The book is This is Cancer, Everything You Need to Know from the Waiting Room to the Bedroom. Our guest is cancer survivor Laura Holmes Haddad. And Laura, thank you so much and congratulations on making it through to the other side, and what a story you have to share. Thank you.
Keep writing.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure.
And we'll be back after these words. It seems a fitting segue into speaking about some new breast imaging technology at the Park City Hospital. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Margaret Schneider, owner of Schneider Auto Carrossery Body and Paint. Happy to support KPCW. Located in Salt Lake City since 1984, Schneider Auto offers collision repair and restoration to pre-accident condition for most cars and light trucks. We also negotiate directly with insurance companies. Details, services, and more info at schneiderauto.net.
This is Nanette Bush with Fairway Independent Mortgage, supporter and longtime listener of KPCW. Fairway Independent Mortgage offers personal home, vacation home, and investment property lending. Our mortgage team partners with local realtors to provide our clients with resources to understand the home finance process, located at 1700 Park Avenue or at nanettebush.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Graham Anthony. Well, after the last conversation, the book, This is Cancer, you already know why breast imaging is so important. Our guest, our last guest, Laura Holmes Haddad, survived stage 4 inflammatory breast cancer. Of course, detection is key, and the technology gets better every day. Park City Hospital has just implemented some new breast imaging technology, and joining us to tell us about it is mammography technician Marlene Judd from the hospital. Did I say that right? Boy, all these big words. Good morning, Marlene. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So talk a little bit about, you know, how it used to be with technology and how it is now. I know it has something to do with 3D mammography. Mm-hmm. But what's the new technology that you have at the hospital?
Well, over course of time, we actually started with film screen, and so that was a little bit more difficult and time-consuming and maybe not as easy to read for a radiologist. And then we moved into digital, and that is considered 2D, and that's what we were offering before we got the new 3D dimensions machine. And 2D is more of a still picture, similar to film screen, but much more clearer. And 3D is, I've said this analogy before, like a book, reading the inside of a book. It takes several more slices, anywhere from 50 to 100 more slices. So we're going to give a radiologist still images and then movement with several more images. And so the technology is more in depth. It's more comprehensive, and the FDA considers it superior to the 2D mammogram.
Okay, so it used to be, I know that if you had the sort of image that looked like it could be suspicious, or if there was very dense tissue, mm-hmm. they would send you down to Huntsman mm-hmm. to get the imaging down there as a secondary sort of thing. Was that because Huntsman had this type of technology before anyone else?
I don't think so. I actually think that was because Huntsman has further, maybe not, they have oncologists. They can continue the care on if you are diagnosed with cancer. So you can have further treatment there. So if you go there for follow-up, they can just follow all the way through. You can have your follow-up, and we have been doing that since we opened. You can have your diagnostic imaging done at the hospital there. And we would follow you through even to a lumpectomy. If you have cancer, of course, our doctors there are going to refer you down to someone that is an oncologist to help you with that treatment and carry that forward. But we can do the diagnosis there at the hospital. You can get the further imaging and ultrasound and surgery if you need it at the hospital.
In the primary testing, then, the last several years has been a lot of talk about the false positives mm-hmm. being a major concern of detection is good, but a false positive is an unnecessary scare mm-hmm. For people. And so is the equipment we're talking about now primarily for heightened detection, or does mm-hmm. it improve the results so that we are having fewer false positives?
I do believe we're having fewer false positives on that. As we look and see on that still picture that they're going to get that looks like a 2D, a radiologist might look at that and go, that's a suspicious area, and so they're going to get called back. But when we add the 3D, the pages or slices, the tomosynthesis is what 3D is, then he can look through there, and that suspicion may go away very quickly, and he can be definitive and say, you know, that's just tissue, dense tissue, or glandular summation, tissue upon tissue, that we normally, just looking at the still picture, couldn't say right then. However, they may still get a call back because, you know, if you're not sure, a radiologist is still going to bring you back because you don't want that one little chance to be, hey, she has cancer and or maybe could have cancer, a lesion that is suspicious. They're not going to let that go without having a second look, whether it be back under a 3D tomo image or ultrasound or a biopsy. But that, it's more definitive. It is getting rid of some of those callbacks that might have happened if it was just 2D, but then you still might get a callback because there's an area of a concern. It's not, you know, if it's not definitive at that moment.
How long have you had the 3D technology at the hospital?
We got that in August, and we are super excited. And the women that come now, they think it's faster. I feel like it's a little bit faster. The compression's the same, positioning's the same. The women don't know that they're getting 3D. Like, there's nothing for them to say, hey, this is a lot different. They don't realize the difference.
The same.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's the same. So it's a good experience.
So over the last decade or so, you know, we've heard some things about the level of radiation that you get during a mammogram is, you know, it outweighs the benefits sometimes of detection. We hear about, as Graham says, false positives. We also, you know, sometimes we get biopsies or lumpectomies. And how is that all changing? Is there less radiation with a 3D or?
Okay, so the 3D HD is a little bit less radiation than the conventional 2D. And I would hope that women would consider when you're outside for half of a day in the sun, which a lot of Summit County women are, that is equivalent to getting a mammogram. And so when you're looking at accumulation over time, if you're flying a lot, if you're outside a lot, and then you add one little day or 10 minutes that you're going to have a mammogram, it's not going to change your life or cause you to have cancer. It's more preventative, and it should be considered something as part of your lifestyle to have that opportunity to have a screening. And it won't be, you know, we're very conservative there. We try just not to continually do images and take repeats. We want it just to be the first time, and we're very conscientious of that. And obviously, the women in Summit County, they are a little bit different cat. I've worked in Evanston and in Las Vegas, and I say that with it's in a very good way, because these women are very conscientious of their health, and they are conscientious of the new technology that's out there. And so they're versed when they come. They're educated, and I feel like we can offer that at Park City Hospital, and, you know, in a conservative manner.
Mm-hmm. I will say about Park City Hospital in the mammography department, you go in there and it feels like a spa.
Right.
And so I was wondering, you know, after my mammogram, where my massage was going to be or my facial. Have you added any spa treatments?
Oh, hey, I maybe can put a plug in. But yeah, just up the hall at Live Well.
That's right. That's right. It is a lovely space. And I would call it, you know, it's not a very calming feeling to go for a mammogram, but the atmosphere that you create there, sort of nice lighting and, you know,
some ambiance.
Some ambiance, there you go, some nice music, and it does sort of help the process. And so as we're sitting here talking about it, all those listeners out there who have not scheduled there, we're still at a yearly, right?
Yes, yearly.
Every year. And you're thinking, oh, I need to make an appointment. Don't delay. Don't delay, as our previous conversation was about a full-blown case of breast cancer. So what else is new out there within what you're doing? Do you change up your practices or how you receive patients?
You know, we're not, but at Park City Hospital, we do offer this new machine, the 3D Dimensions. We are able to do upright stereotactic biopsies. So as far as, like, our technology has improved, and that is in the Intermountain Healthcare, we are the only ones that have the upright stereo biopsy. It's much more comfortable. And I hope that no woman ever has to have that. And it kind of makes me emotional.
Hmm. Well, talk a little bit about, I don't, okay, so a biopsy is something where you are there's an incision mm-hmm. and there's some mass taken out, but mm-hmm. that happens when you're standing?
No, you're going to be sitting upright. Oh. So it used to be you laid on a table and it could be a little bit claustrophobic and it hurt your neck quite a bit. It was uncomfortable. Mm. And then it's like your breast is in a vice grip, but that's really the reality of it. And now we can do it upright and we try to defer the patients, you know, where they're looking and try and distract them so they're not really seeing what's going on. But physically, it is so much more comfortable and so much more faster because it's under tomosynthesis, so it's triangulated. And we can do them in just a few minutes now. And where before, it would take about 20 to 30 minutes.
Oh, wow.
From beginning to end. But we, you know, technology, we've mastered that in the technology field now. So we really are excited to offer that technology here in Park City. And we've been able to do patients from the Uinta Basin and down in Provo because we have that. So it's exciting. Park City Hospital is on top of it, and we're so excited to offer these new technologies to you guys.
And so have you replaced all of the old gear, or is this an upgrade?
We've replaced it. Okay. It's gone. Okay. So we don't have the stereo table. We have the new Dimensions 3D machine, mammography machine. We're in a different room. It's bigger. It's pleasant. We've painted. We've got, you know, nice, beautiful robes. Hopefully we have a great staff.
The robes. That's what I remember.
You got to have the robes.
I guess I'm never going to be in there, but it sounds like a nice place.
Oh,
I guess you'd move the old machines on KSL.com.
I'm not sure that they went there, but they went somewhere. We'd still give you a tour even if you didn't want to come and, you know, have a mammogram.
I'm due for a visit to the Live Well Center anyway.
Oh, there you go. Yes, stop by.
One more definition
of the word.
It's
my birthday, you know.
That's right. We have talked about this.
Chapstick and a nail file for you then.
Oh, thank you so much.
And they're waiting for you at the Live Well Center. You said upright stereotactic?
Mm-hmm.
What's that mean?
So stereotactic is... we're going to use a needle and go into the breast and take core samples, so tissue of the breast. And then we're going to image that on a machine to see if we have the calcifications. Stereotactic is we're looking for microcalcifications. We see them on the image, and then we want to get some of those out and take a biopsy of that. Calcifications can indicate changing tissue and can be positive for cancer, but we have to have those biopsies first and that tissue to say. So that's what it is, and it's kind of scary. But, you know, we get women through it, and we try to make it as positive as we can, and I think we enjoy the experience with them.
That's right. Marlene Judd is a mammography technician at the Park City Hospital telling us about this new 3D technology. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
You can tell that you're very passionate about your job.
Thank you.
And we want to thank our underwriters today, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, Phil Davidson Orthopedics, Park City Mountain, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Fairway Independent Mortgage, and Valley Behavioral Health.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, FredMarshallPainting.com. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with the birthday boy, Graham Anthony, thanks for joining me this morning, Graham.
My great life's accomplishment.
Turning
another
year
birthday.
Older. Hey.
Survival.
Well, yes, at least you're doing it, right? Interesting show today. We want to thank Marlene Judd again and also Laura Holmes Haddad with her book, This is Cancer, Everything You Need to Know from the Waiting Room to the Bedroom, along with Barbara Warasco Morelli and Donnell Pons to talk about dyslexia, October being Dyslexia Awareness Month. Again, tonight at the high school, Drs. Wilson presenting a talk on dyslexia. You're listening to KPCW.